And Matt Stanley with us as we talk about his work, Einstein's War. We will take your calls this hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Matt Stanley with us. We'll get your calls as well, Einstein's War. Matt, what was it about Einstein that captured your attention that got you to write the book Einstein's War?
I think one of the things that really got my attention was the mismatch between our ideal of Einstein as this, you know, disembodied genius who just sits at a desk and creates pure knowledge, versus the actual Einstein, who is this person who was sick all the time and liked swimming at the beach and relied on his friends and loved playing the violin and was constantly forgetting his keys. And I wanted to tell a story about the real Einstein and about how all those things really matter for the practice of science.
Was he very verbal in English?
He was surprisingly verbal in English, actually. He doesn't learn English until fairly late in life. He doesn't really dedicate himself to it until he's living here.
Uh-huh.
So by then, he's, what, in his 50s? But he learns it well enough that he can converse with the media and children he runs into on the street and give public lectures. So actually, on YouTube, you can find videos of him talking in English without too much trouble.
I assume he left everything behind in Germany, his possessions, everything, huh?
That's right. Some of it he gets back later, thanks to his heroic secretary, a woman named Helen Ducasse, who manages to recover some of his stuff and get it to him in the United States after World War II is over. But for the most part, when the Nazis come to power, Einstein has his clothes on his back and a trunk of clothes, and that's it.
Well, I was going to say, he came here in 1933. We weren't at war with the Germans at the time, so in between, was there still tension going on there in Germany? I guess the purge was underway already at that point?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, so many of, I think I'd mentioned before, about a third of the scientists in Germany leave Europe when the Nazis come to power. And that's an enormous number, right? So all of those people are Einstein's colleagues and friends and acquaintances. So he spends a lot of time and energy finding new homes for all those people, new jobs at American universities, finding places where they can settle into new lives.
How did the Germans possess such great scientific minds at the time, which includes not only the ones that left earlier, but those that stayed, and we got them under Project Paperclip after the war.
Right.
But I mean, how did Germany get to accumulate so many incredible minds?
Well, it was the result of sort of a deliberate government policy. So Germany is a fairly young country, right? Germany isn't a unified country until 1871. That can be hard to remember. And one of the things that they decide as a new nation is that they want to lead the world in intellectual and scientific matters. So they put huge resources into their universities, into their primary schools, and specifically into what come to be called the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, which are sort of the world's first large-scale government-funded research centers.
Well, they did the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, I should say it really worked. And then, as you say, we get all of those scientists either before or right after World War II, and American science goes from being a backwater to being the most important in the world. So in an important sense, this country benefits greatly from German educational policy around 1900.
Have a great time here with our listeners, Matt. With the remaining time we've got this hour, we'll take phone calls. Let's go to Keith in Virginia. Welcome to the program to get us started. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Hey, it's good talking to you again. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Do you remember when, soon after Stephen Hawking's passing, that you and I talked
yep.
to his colleague and
yep.
friend, Leonard Mlodinow?
Leonard Mlodinow, exactly.
Yeah, I forgot to mention, actually, that I guess you could say I had the honor of a someone that Albert Einstein called his colleague, called me his best friend when I lived in Sacramento.
Really? How cool.
Yeah. Yeah, he had, his name was Paul Andrew Lang, and he had a remarkable life that I wanted to mention, and I don't know if your guest has heard of him. But basically, what it, he was a student of Einstein's at the institute there in Princeton that he mentioned, and on the campus of Princeton University. And he later, and in fact, because he had grown up in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and as a child spoke six languages, including German, that's why he had a good connection with his professor Einstein, and he called him his colleague. And he mentioned, you were talking about music. One of the stories he told me was that Einstein was in a quartet with three professors from Princeton there. And they got frustrated with him because his timing was not very good in the music. And they were so frustrated, one of them burst out, "Can't you count?" And then they realized what they had just said to Albert Einstein.
That's funny. But, yeah, Lang died in 1991 in Connecticut, didn't he?
I'm sorry?
Lang died in Connecticut.
No, actually, he passed. This is Paul Andrew Lang.
Andrew, not Henry. Okay.
Yeah, he was. He actually had gone on to do a lot of things in science. He passed away in Sacramento in 1998, I believe it was. I knew him just before his death. I met him actually in church on the back pew, and he was just a humble old man. And I sat down and started talking to him, and you never know who you're going to come across when you have a conversation with somebody. But he later had been head of biomechanical engineering at UCLA. He had worked on Apollo space missions, on the Apollo guidance systems, the computer guidance systems for Apollo space missions. He had invented weather forecasting instruments in the nose of airplanes that forecast weather out about 100 miles. He had had patents on 44 instruments for heart surgery and eye surgery. Also was in the Army, and he lost 24 of his 36 men at D-Day.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, and just an amazing, wonderful gentleman.
Well, I'm glad he had a chance to have his life touch yours, Keith. I mean, that's fantastic. It's a small world, Matt, sometimes,
right? That's right. It's a fascinating character. Yeah.
It really is. Thank you, Keith. Appreciate it. Let's go to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Was Einstein ever consulted by Hollywood, for sci-fi movies about time travel and whatnot? And did he scoff at their attempt at making such movies?
Well, he died in 55. I'm not sure if Hollywood ever tapped into his mind, Matt. Did it?
Not to my knowledge, no. But certainly Einstein's ideas are hugely inspirational in the middle of the 20th century, not just to movies, but to literature as well. So, you know, the ideas about the malleability of time or the conversion of matter to energy, really, it's not an accident that science fiction takes off in the middle of the 20th century, just as Einstein's theories really come to prominence.
Will people generally have a different view of Einstein when they read the book Einstein's War?
Yeah, I think so, or at least I hope so. And I really want people to understand that Einstein was a person who had stomach aches and desires and loves and hates. That scientists are people like us, right? Just because Einstein was smart didn't mean that he didn't love his children and like listening to music.
We go to Sherry in Memphis, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, George. Hello, sir. I have two questions.
All right.
What is, did Einstein ever meet or know and talk to Werner von Braun, who, my understanding, von Braun and James Van Allen starting NASA? Do they have any ideas about starting an organization like NASA maybe at the time before he died? And my second question is, how did his wife relate to man who, but did not understand his work, and he must have spent a huge part of every day doing his work? How did they relate to living with him?
That's interesting. First off, did he know Wernher von Braun? I would think he did.
Well, as far as I know, I should say there's no documentary evidence that they ever met. And that is quite possible. So von Braun's, you know, very concerned with military application. Einstein definitely is not. So it's entirely possible that they never met. And certainly politically, we're very different. So if they did meet, we don't have a documentary evidence of it. And the second question is sort of, what was it like to live with Einstein?
Yeah, if you were his wife.
Yeah, so I should say I would not have wanted to be Einstein's wife. He was not especially a good husband. Very focused on his work, so he would often disappear into his office for hours at a time. And his wife describes that he'd come down from his office suddenly and go over to the piano and hit one or two keys on the piano and think for a moment and then go back up to his office.
Huh.
Generally, people weren't allowed in his office unless he invited them. Nobody was allowed to, you know, tidy up or clean. He definitely felt that his work was the center of the family, and other things came secondary to that.
And as extracurriculars?
Yes, and extracurriculars, things like music, hiking. We don't think of Einstein as hiking, but when he lived in Switzerland, he was up in the mountains every weekend, particularly with his children. That was one of his favorite things to do with his sons, was to go hiking in the mountains. And then later in life, he picks up sailing.
No, interesting. Was he a happy person, Matt?
You know, despite all the tragedy of his life, I think the answer is yes, certainly by the end. You know, he had his greatest ideas confirmed and embraced by the world. He ended up with a family who he loved deeply and who loved him deeply. He was admired all around the world. I think he probably would have liked a little less attention.
We're taking calls with Matt Stanley, talking about his book, Einstein's War. What are you working on next, Matt?
I am looking at how scientists talk about the end of the world, actually. So, you know, it used to be we went to our religious prophets for stories about how the world was going to end. But now we go to our scientists for that. So I'm interested in how that came to be.
First-time caller Eric in Houston, Texas. Welcome to the program, Eric. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to, Einstein was one of the greatest minds of his time.
He sure was.
By far. And he was asked one time how it was like to be one of the greatest minds of his time. He said, "I do not know. Ask Nikola Tesla."
I like that. Hey, thanks.
Yeah. Einstein was always good for a fast quip. Actually, which is a pretty impressive thing to do in your third language, right?
I tell a little Einstein story at some of my speaking events, Matt, and Einstein had a driver who looked just like him. He had white hair, fluffy, and everything else. And one day Einstein was just exhausted, and he told the driver, he says, I just can't give any more speeches tonight. I'm done. And the driver said, "Mr. Einstein, you have to go to this event. You have to do this." And he said, "No." He said, "Look, you put my tuxedo on. You do it, because nobody's going to know the difference. Let's fluff your hair up a little bit more. You've got a mustache. It's all white, just like mine. Nobody will know." And he said, "Okay, Mr. Einstein." So they do. They switch clothes. Einstein's in the back of the room. The driver who's portraying Einstein is on the podium talking and stuff, and then they're doing a little Q&A right at the end. And some guy said, "Mr. Einstein, Professor Einstein, can you elaborate more on your theory of relativity in E equals MC squared? And Einstein, the driver, said, "Well, I can't give you that answer, but my driver in the back can."
That's a good story. Yeah, I should say there's a few stories out there of mistaken identity of that sort for Einstein, particularly when he first became famous and people didn't immediately recognize him. So there's stories of him milling around and people at parties and people mistaking him for the waiter or whatnot because he was dressed so shabbily. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Don in Wall Creek. Well, welcome to the program, West of the Rockies. Hey, Donald, go ahead.
Hey. I was just wondering if your guests would talk about Einstein's efforts to unify gravity and electricity and magnetism using a fourth spatial dimension or a fifth dimension. I thought that was really neat. And how the dimension is rolled up in some interpretations?
Yeah, so this is, I alluded to earlier in the show, so physics today is in this weird position of having two great theories. It's got the theory of general relativity, and it's got the theory of quantum mechanics. And during Einstein's day, there was this great split, and these two theories are incompatible in an important way. So Einstein spends the last 20 years of his life trying to figure out some way to unify these, and as the caller suggests, one way to think about this is that the goal is to take gravity and electricity and magnetism, all the things we know about the universe, and explain them all as different manifestations of some single force. This is why we call it a unified field theory. And Einstein's idea for this was to try and explain away the mysteries of quantum mechanics by showing that they were essentially errors that humans had made, and that relativity was the deep truth of the universe. And I should say he fails at this, right? Einstein goes to his grave without successfully having done this, but the quest of trying to unify these things is still around today. And string theory is one of the most important versions of that. And it's in string theory that we get this idea of the extra rolled up dimensions that the caller referred to. And the idea is that the way we experience the universe, the sort of three spatial dimensions and one dimension of time, might only be a shadow of the true nature of reality. So maybe there's lots of dimensions out there, and we just see a tiny fraction of those. The trick then is to design, say, experiments and theories that can let us peer into those higher dimensions and find out what's really going on in the universe.
Matt, did Einstein have an IQ that was off the charts?
I don't know. So IQ is still a relatively new tool when Einstein was in school. So to the best of my knowledge, he never had a formal IQ test. IQ is a pretty lousy way of measuring these things in any case.
That's true. So true. Let's go next to Terrence in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the program. Hi, Terrence. Go ahead.
Thank you, George. I just want to tell you, you truly are a national treasure. It's an honor to talk to you tonight.
Thank you.
I have a neat little story. When I was in high school, my high school teacher, she was kind of one of these teachers that they kept, I think, probably into her 70s. And she told us this interesting story about Einstein and the day he actually left Germany. And it's interesting. I think your guest mentioned the name of the secretary, and I always thought it was weird. She mentioned this, her friend, my science teacher, was a secretary or kind of an adjutant or somebody for a helper or somebody that did everything, I think, to making his lunch every day for him. So he was to come home. He had told his wife and his children that day to put several layers of clothes on, but not to take any bags, and that a car would come and pick them up.
Hold that story right there, Terrence, and we'll get you right after the break. Well, next hour, Len Kasten joins me as we talk about the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Was it the real deal? Len will fill us in on some amazing things. So that'll be next hour on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to come back in a moment with final calls with Matt Stanley as we talk about his work, Einstein's War. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment here with Matt Stanley, his book, Einstein's War. Let's go back to Terrence in Portland, Oregon, who had this great story he was going to tell us. Hey, Terrence, I'll let you fill it in. Go ahead.
Great, George. So anyway, this is a story from my high school teacher, and I was lucky enough to hear this as I dawned on me all over these years, because I was a freshman, and this was her very last year. And I'm 47 now, so to hear a story like this, and I was on the edge of my seat back when she told me, but she was apparently friends with his, housekeeper or secretary helper in Germany back in the years later. But mm-hmm. She told us, or the class, that there was one day that came, and he had instructed his wife, and I think there was two children there, and there's some things maybe your guest can verify. they were to dress up in as many layers of clothes as they could, not to take any bags in the morning. And then, or sometime by the lunchtime, he would come home for his normal lunch. He had like a real simple paper bag kind of lunch. And then a car would pick him up, and then they would go rendezvous somewhere. And I think it was either by plane or train they made it out. And I never knew what year it was, but I knew it was must have been early, because it sounded like he barely made it out before they started to tighten up on a lot of the, you know, exiting laws and things like that. One thing I do remember is her saying, literally, when his car drove away, the Gestapo apparently literally pulled up within the state, just within seconds.
Wow.
That they were already on his trail. So even though it was early on, we got the impression that he really barely made it out.
That's amazing timing for him, Matt, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I'm not sure about the details of the story, because Einstein was abroad when the Nazis came to storm his home. But I should say that there are very similar versions of that story told by multiple people who flee the Nazis once they come to power. So I wonder if that might be a conflation of a couple different family stories of people fleeing Germany at the time.
What a time that must have been for so many people, too, huh?
Yeah, it's really it's genuinely terrifying, right, to imagine.
How well did Einstein know Nikola Tesla?
I don't know if they ever met as well. As with von Braun, I'm not sure if they ever met. But Tesla was certainly a well-known person, at least as a kind of ideal personality at the time. So even if they had never met, Einstein certainly would have known who Tesla was.
Yeah, I'm sure Tesla and Edison didn't get along, but I wonder how those two would have.
That would have been an interesting pair, actually. I would have liked to sit down to tea with them.
Pat in Minneapolis, east of the Rockies. Hi, Pat, go ahead.
Three fast ones. At Bellevue Hospital in New York City, my father looked at his brain in a glass container, and where the rest of us have really thin thread-like little circulation, he had a vessel as big around as your thumb, so his brain was really different.
Hmm.
And Marilyn Monroe had in her personal effects a picture that he had sent her of himself with a thank you note on it. So I think she was one of his special friends.
Maybe.
And the third thing I know is that, like that movie Hidden Figures, his first wife did all his calculations for him. And when they got divorced, they had an agreement that if he ever won the Nobel Prize, she would get the money. And that's exactly what happened. She got the money.
Was she a scientist, Matt? Do you know?
She was also a physics major, so they met in their physics classes. And she's part of the group that Einstein is hanging out with when he's a young man working on his early theories. And it's, I should say, it's this, as the caller suggests, some people wonder whether or not his first wife, Maleva, had done a lot of his work. I should say there really isn't much evidence for this. Einstein certainly has a long career after her, without much trouble, and she never claims that she does any of his work, nor does anyone else around at the time. But even if she had, I should say, you know, it was extremely difficult to be a woman in the sciences 100 years ago. It's still hard today. So whatever work she did do, she certainly wouldn't have gotten credit for.
Did industry employ him at all?
Yeah, so a little bit. So Einstein actually grows up in electrical industry. His father and his uncle run a electrotechnology company. They're installing the first electric streetlights
here
in Germany.
In Germany. Okay.
Yeah, so Einstein grows up around machines, which is not really what we're used to thinking about. And when he's in college, he likes doing experiments. And even when he's a young professor, he's building machines, and he holds a couple of patents. So he always likes gadgets, I think is probably the best way to think about it. He would have been an early adopter today.
Interesting take. Omaha, Nebraska, we go. Hello, John, take it away.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. And we like your two arms.
Boy, that was Tommy. Check his phone. Let's see what happened. We needed Einstein to fix that one.
That's right.
Let's go to Mayotte in New York. Welcome to the program. Hi, Mayotte.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. Matt, I'm going to contest your comment you made about the first wife. Her name begins with an M and is somewhat unusual, but PBS. About 7 or 8 years or so ago, don't remember exactly, they did a documentary and on the theory of relativity, I believe it was, in 1905, the wife was signed on to the paper presenting the theory. That type of information and documentary has gone down the memory hole, but they actually showed the paper of the original theory, and of course you said she did all the calculations, and then there was some deal or whatever, you know, but her name never came up again. But it seems like when you consider the times, I hope you will research it.
You're talking about Maliva. That's her name.
Yes. Thank you, George. Maliva. But it was shocking to see the theory of relativity. And I believe her name was the primary one. So, Matt, I like your comments, and I'd like you to research it. Also, I didn't hear you flesh out when George asked about what happened to his family, his parents, in terms of what went down in Nazi Germany. And I'll listen over the air. Things are not quite what they always seem. Thank you.
Okay.
Definitely true. I think if there's a lesson of relativity, it's that things are not always what they seem. Yeah. So Einstein's parents had both died before the Nazis came to power, so they were exempted from that particular horror. And his sons were living with his ex-wife in Switzerland, so they were also out of reach. So it was his wife and stepdaughters that had to escape the Nazis, which they were able to do, I should say. The Nazis seemed less interested in them than in Einstein, per se.
Next up, we go to Michael in Portland, Oregon, first-time caller. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen, from a long, long-time listener.
Well, thank you, sir.
Well, I want to tell a story. I was in the Navy in the early 70s, and a gentleman in naval intelligence told me a story about the Philadelphia experiment. And thank God for your show. It helped fill in some gaps. But I heard that Einstein and Tesla were involved in some way in this experiment. Do you know anything about this?
Do you remember that story, Matt, the Philadelphia experiment?
I do, yeah. So no, Einstein was not involved with the Philadelphia experiment. During World War II, his only contributions were writing the letter to FDR to jumpstart the Manhattan Project, and then some work for the Navy on torpedo detonation techniques. And he never actually touched any machines. These were purely theoretical. And the reason, I should say, that Einstein doesn't do much war work during World War II is because people are suspicious of his politics. That is, they're worried he might be a communist. So he's actually not allowed to work on the Manhattan Project or anything interesting like the Philadelphia experiment.
When Einstein died, it was suddenly, wasn't it?
Yeah, relatively speaking, but he was in his 70s. I think no one was particularly shocked.
I think he was waiting to do some television interview because he was speaking about the state of Israel. It was an anniversary date, and he died.
That could be. I would have to look that up. And he does go, in a matter of hours, if I remember right. And it's often pointed out that we don't know what his last words were because they were in German. And the nurse that was with him only spoke English.
Let's go to Joe in Monterey, California now. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, guys. I got a question. Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure.
By the way, I have two questions, very quick. One is about the controversy in the Big Bang and the redshift. Can you talk a little bit, I don't know if you can, about frequency attenuated light being a possible cause for the redshift, and maybe there was no Big Bang? Also, maybe that's enough. What is your opinion on UFOs and the probability of life in the universe?
Well, we'll save that one for next hour, because that's what we're talking about.
That's fair.
I should say, even though modern cosmology, like the Big Bang Theory, is based on Einstein's ideas, he himself was not really part of the genesis of those, excuse the pun, of those ideas and of the theory of the Big Bang. It's really the next generation of astronomers and cosmologists that look into these things. As for the question of whether, the conventional interpretation of the redshift is that the galaxy, other galaxies are receding from us at great speed, and that creates the redshift effect. And that's where we get the idea of the expanding universe from. And if you backtrack that, then you get the Big Bang. There are lots of other alternative explanations to the redshift. Tired light theory, frequency attenuation, dust absorption, and so on. And all of these have been looked at quite thoroughly and generally put to the side. So it takes some years before scientists settle on the idea of the expanding universe as the best interpretation for the redshift, but that's definitely where we are today.
Did Einstein ever win a Nobel Prize?
He did in 1921, and interestingly, not for the theory of relativity, but rather for some other work he did called the photoelectric effect. And this is because the wording of Nobel's will seems to imply it's supposed to be for a discovery rather than an idea. So relativity was thought of as being too abstract and theoretical, so they give it to him for something else.
Let's go to Tim in New Orleans, east of the Rockies. Squeeze you in here, Timmy. Go ahead.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I just have a quick question. I've read some articles. I don't have any sources for anything that Einstein may have been on the autism spectrum. I was wondering if there was any evidence or truth of that or anything like that.
Did he have any autistic tendencies?
Yeah, so people point to things like his general social awkwardness. He doesn't speak until very late when he's a child. His general sort of flouting of social norms. So some people like to point to that as suggesting he's on the autistic spectrum somewhere. And I should say it's entirely possible. It's very difficult to diagnose historical figures in modern categories like this, so it's hard to know. And I think I would lean towards saying he was not on the spectrum, if for no other reason than the fact that he had lots of really rich social relationships.
Yeah,
right? He had close friends. He had very intense, passionate.
Was he a savant?
He could well have been a savant. That said, he was actually, as a kid, not particularly smart. He did fine in school, but certainly none of his teachers pointed to him and said, that's somebody who's going to change the world.
Interesting take. Well, thank you, Matt, for being on the program. And where do people get your book, Einstein's War?
You can get it on Amazon or any of the major booksellers.
All right, my friend. Stay in touch. And when your next project's done, get back to us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Next up, Len Kasten back with us on Coast to Coast. We will talk about some incredible things that have to do with extraterrestrials right here on Coast to Coast AM.